I say the name Saddam Hussein, what words come to mind? Dictator? Narcissist? Murderer? Stalin-esque strongman? How many of you out there thought, student of history, patron of the arts, or novelist? Yes, Iraq's former leader was many things, and believe it or not, he even tried his hand at writing fiction. Now, to be fair, Saddam Hussein's career as a novelist is kind of like Charles Manson's career as a folk singer. The art is more than a little overshadowed by other aspects of their lives. But the best known of Saddam Hussein's novels is a romantic piece of historical fiction called Zabiba and the King. The novel was published anonymously in the year 2000 using the traditional Arabic anonymous nom de plume, "It was written by he who wrote it." So, technically, anyone could have written Zabiba and the King, but given the style of the text and the clearly pro-regime themes that run through it, it's pretty clear who the author was. The CIA, at least, are convinced that Zabiba and the King was written by Saddam himself, or perhaps Saddam and a team of ghostwriters. What is it about? Well, I'm glad you asked. Zabiba and the King takes place in medieval Iraq, specifically in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. Zabiba is a beautiful but poor peasant woman who is terrorized by her cruel husband. The husband and his gang of brigands are also plotting to overthrow the just and heroic king. The loyal Zabiba alerts the king to the plot, but then tragically dies in battle against her husband's treasonous gang. The king then hunts down those who dishonored the blameless Zabiba and gallantly avenges her death. Now, if you ask readers like the Middle Eastern scholar Ofra Bengio, the story is a loose allegory for how Saddam Hussein liked to portray himself. According to Bengio, the king is clearly a stand-in for Saddam. Zabiba is the living embodiment of the Iraqi people, or at least the Iraqi people as Saddam conceived of them. And the evil husband and his gang of miscreants are all of Iraq's enemies, as defined by Hussein. Foreign colonizers, the United States, and of course, the Israelis. The message is pretty clear. The king protects the people from those who would abuse and exploit them. The king is good. But aside from the obviously propagandistic elements of the text, other readers couldn't help but notice the novel's other literary allusions. While the story is set in medieval Iraq, the author often directs his reader to think back to even earlier periods in the region's history, to ancient Babylon, Assyria, and Sumer. The king in the novel is part of a legacy that extends back millennia to the very start of human civilization. So, of course, references to Gilgamesh abound. You see, it turns out that Saddam Hussein had a particular fascination with Gilgamesh and the ancient society that produced his epic. Even before Saddam became Iraq's undisputed leader, his Ba'ath Party was trying to forge a pan-Iraqi identity in a country that was defined by its religious, ethnic, and tribal factions. To this end, the ruling party explicitly promoted the ancient Mesopotamian past as a shared history for all these disparate groups. After Saddam seized power in 1979, he continued this project with serious gusto. He commissioned huge works of restoration to bring back millennia-old monuments. Even works of theater were sponsored by the state, foremost among them being an adaptation of, you guessed it, Gilgamesh. The elaborate theater production essentially became required viewing in Iraq, It even briefly went on tour and was performed in neighboring Syria. As late as 2002, Hussein was making plans to rebuild Ashurbanipal's great library in the ruins of the ancient city of Nineveh. You might remember, that was where the famous tablets containing the most complete version of the Epic of Gilgamesh had been discovered. Iraqi officials were even in negotiations with the British Museum to have plaster casts made of the tablets so they might be displayed proudly in the restored library. But, of course, world events ensured that this ambitious project never came to fruition. By February of 2003, the United States was loudly demanding that Saddam Hussein step down as the leader of Iraq and go into exile. It was at that time that, reportedly, Saddam gave a speech in front of a group of his assembled generals, where he apparently batted around the idea of leaving the country. Sure enough, in that speech, Hussein referenced Gilgamesh. He mentioned the king as a heroic example of a leader who left his land behind in order to find glory and immortality far from home. He apparently said, quote, "The king gave up the helm and left his Senate leading the country until his return," end quote. In the end, Hussein chose not to relinquish power on his own accord. But I'm fascinated by the fact that as he flirted with the idea, he had Gilgamesh on his mind. Hussein actively tried to frame his regime in the context of the ancient kings of Mesopotamia. And this was always a bit of a stretch. But this connection to Gilgamesh may have been one of the most honest pieces of continuity between the 20th century autocrat and the monarchs of Babylonia or Assyria. In times of crisis, kings from that part of the world often consulted the Epic of Gilgamesh for wisdom and lessons. Part of the reason the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal had the epic recopied and safely stored in his grand library in Nineveh was because he saw it as essential reading for a king. But what lesson is the reader supposed to take from the Epic of Gilgamesh? Well, it's hard to know, especially given the broken form in which it currently exists. The poem is famously uneven. Gilgamesh expert Michael Schmidt put it poetically when he wrote, quote, "Few poems provide such uncertain, yet sometimes exhilarating rewards. Reading is a matter of tuning and retuning. Given the damaged state of the tablets and the ambiguities of the language in which it survives, we can never tune into the poem precisely. They're static, and the volume refuses to be evenly controlled." End quote. I love this radio station analogy. It does seem like the story of Gilgamesh comes in fits and bursts, like you're on a road trip tuning into a faraway station. Just when you think you got something, you drive out of range. This leaves lots of room for interpretation. Is Gilgamesh really a good model for kingship? Or is he a cautionary tale? Or is there a bit of both? What did a guy like Saddam Hussein take from this epic? Anything? Or was it just a handy piece of national literature easily adapted into propaganda? If the Epic of Gilgamesh really did provide lessons for kings, then we have to wonder if the king at the center of the story ever actually lived. Is Gilgamesh a purely mythical figure meant to represent the institution of kingship itself? Or was he based on a real guy? If there was a real Gilgamesh, did he truly deserve this epic reputation? Let's find out today on Our Fake History. episode number 130. Was there a real Gilgamesh? Part 2. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast where we explore historical myths and try to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we return to our examination of one of humanity's oldest stories, the ancient Mesopotamian Epic of Gilgamesh. Now, as many of you have already noticed, this is part two of what is going to be a two-part series on Gilgamesh. So, if you haven't heard part one, then I strongly suggest you go back and give that a listen now. In part one, I told the tale of Gilgamesh, or at least I gave my version of how the tale of Gilgamesh appears in the Assyrian tablets that were first translated by the British researcher George Smith. I also gave a little background on Smith himself and his unlikely journey to being the man who first translated the epic after it was buried for well over 2,000 years. So, in today's episode, I'm going to be referencing the epic like we all know what's going on. So, as always, make sure you're caught up before venturing any further. This week, I'm hoping to give Gilgamesh the same treatment I gave to the Trojan War, King Arthur, and Robin Hood, and that is, parse the legend for any crumbs of history that might be hidden inside. The biggest question I want to answer today was whether or not Gilgamesh was based on a real person. Now, when you start diving into the academic discussion of the Epic of Gilgamesh, many scholars like to point out how slippery the poem is, especially when it comes to using it as a historical source. As I mentioned in the introduction, some of these scholars can't help but get poetic about this. You could probably tell how much I enjoyed that Michael Schmidt radio analogy that I used in the cold open. But not to be outdone, another Gilgamesh expert, the author David Damrosch, has offered this take on the epic. Quote, "In drawing, perspective lines that recede into the distance ultimately converge in what artists call the vanishing point. Pressing beyond the old Babylonian epic in search of the historical Gilgamesh, it's possible to glimpse his shadowy form at the very edge of vision on the threshold of history." End quote. Nice. Gilgamesh sits at the vanishing point, the spot where myth and history converge. When observed from a distance, it seems as though they occupy the same space. You know I love me a good analogy, and the Gilgamesh scholars know how to bring it. I tip my hat. But even though the very ancientness of the Epic of Gilgamesh has made it particularly challenging as a historical document, that hasn't stopped scholars from trying to sift the fact from the fiction. In fact, speculation about the history contained in the epic began almost immediately after the tablets were translated in the 1870s. George Smith, the self-taught British translator of the epic, believed that the tablets of Gilgamesh were filled with historical nuggets. Most significantly, he believed that the tale of the flood found on tablet 11 aligned so closely with the tale of the deluge in the Torah and Old Testament that this acted as important evidence attesting to the reality of a massive ancient flood. Smith explained these ideas in detail in his 1876 book, The Chaldean Account of Genesis. And for those of you unfamiliar, that word Chaldean is just another name used for the Neo-Babylonian civilization that gets referenced a lot in the Bible. So, in that book, Smith made the case that while the accounts of the flood in the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Old Testament differ in a number of significant ways, the fact that they have so many similarities speaks to a regional memory of a real great flood. Now, Smith actually had a pretty nuanced understanding of how different cultural norms, religious ideas, and storytelling tropes could affect the transmission of a legend, or at least nuanced for the 1870s. He very perceptively explained that the differences between the two flood stories were the result of differences in culture between the ancient Jewish writers of the Torah and the ancient Mesopotamians. Smith wrote, quote, "There was a total difference between the religious ideas of the two peoples, the Jews believing in one God, the Creator and Lord of the universe, while the Babylonians worshipped gods and lords many, every city having its local deity, and these being joined by complicated relations in a poetical mythology, which was in marked contrast to the severe simplicity of the Jewish system. With such differences, it was not only natural, in relating the same stories, each nation should color them in accordance with its own ideas, and stress would naturally in each case be laid upon points with which they were familiar. Thus, we should expect beforehand that there would be differences in the narrative, such as we actually find." End quote. It's a fair point, and one that has stood up remarkably well over the last 150 years. In fact, David Damrosch, the scholar I quoted earlier, makes a very similar point about the contrasting flood stories in his 2007 History of the Epic. But where Smith differed from many modern scholars was that Smith believed that the biblical flood really happened, or at least a large regional flood really happened, and the existence of the flood narrative in Gilgamesh clearly supported that. Now, as longtime listeners know, this is something we have explored on this show before. When we looked at the legend of Atlantis, and when we examined the theories of Graham Hancock, we considered the question of whether or not a real event could have inspired the legends of an ancient cataclysmic flood. So, if you want all of my thoughts on the flood, you really need to go back and give those episodes a listen. I have mused before about how weirdly cross-cultural flood myths are. You find them in cultures as diverse as ancient China to the Anishinaabe First Nation here in Ontario. But because of the cultural footprint of the Torah and the Old Testament of the Bible, the flood stories from the Middle East have held a particular fascination for scholars. This has led many to hunt for evidence of a large regional flood in that part of the world that may have accounted for that legend. However, at the time of this recording, evidence for that particular cataclysmic flood is pretty scant. If you have an amazing memory, then you might recall that back in the series on Atlantis, I brought up the Black Sea Deluge hypothesis. That was the theory that was first proposed by geophysicists Walter Pittman and William Ryan in 1997. Now, I've spoken about this hypothesis before, so I'm not going to go too deep here, but in a nutshell, these researchers believed that they had found evidence that around the end of the last ice age, the retreat of the glaciers led to a huge flooding event when the waters of the Mediterranean rose and suddenly inundated the Black Sea, which up to that point had been a large freshwater glacial lake. They proposed that the waters flowed into the Black Sea with a power 200 times that of Niagara Falls for a steady 300 days. This rapid expansion of the Black Sea would have drastically altered the shoreline and would have wiped out any nearby settlements. Their proposal was simple. This traumatic event stayed in the memory of the local people and eventually inspired the story of both Noah and Utnapishtim. But one thing I didn't spend enough time explaining back in season 2, when I first told you about this hypothesis, was how poorly this particular theory has fared in the face of new research. Since 1997, a number of researchers, including Lvivu Gioson, Florin Philip, and Stefan Constantinescu, have presented their own studies on the hydrology and geology of the Black Sea. These studies have demonstrated that the inundation of the Black Sea was a much more gradual event. They did not see evidence of a wild 300-day flood. In 2011, the researcher Valentina Yanko-Homba further damaged the Black Sea deluge hypothesis when she pointed out that there's absolutely no archaeological evidence that any human settlements by the Black Sea were either destroyed or disrupted by Pittman's and Ryan's proposed deluge. So it seems far less likely now that there was one cataclysmic regional flood that inspired these stories from the Fertile Crescent. Instead, David Damrosch has argued that it's important to consider the significance of flooding as a part of Mesopotamian daily life. Floods were a very common occurrence for a society that had grown up along two large rivers. Floods were particularly destructive to early Mesopotamian settlements that were mostly built of mud brick. So, Damrosch argues that this influenced the way these cultures communicated. Mesopotamian writing was filled with flood imagery. The flood was used as a popular metaphor for any type of destruction in the records of the Sumerian, Babylonian, and Assyrian kings. Armies are described as overwhelming cities, quote, like a flood. When the Assyrian king Sennacherib sacked Babylon in the 600s BC, he would crow in the official account that, quote, I made its destruction more complete than by that of a flood, end quote. So, in Damrosch's reading, the flood was simply the preferred metaphor for destruction used by the people of Mesopotamia. The point is that searching for one big flood misses the point of this trope in Mesopotamian writing. So despite George Smith's excitement over the flood story, evidence for a real great flood in ancient West Asia is thinner than ever. But that doesn't mean that the Epic of Gilgamesh should be written off completely as a historical text. On the contrary, quite a lot may be lurking inside this poem. So let's take a closer look and see what we can uncover. If we're going to comb through the Epic of Gilgamesh in search of historical facts, then we should start with the setting. It's notable that this story is set in a very real geographic location. While Gilgamesh travels to fantastical locales like Utnapishtim's faraway land over the sea, most of the story takes place in and around the city of Uruk. And Uruk was 100% a real place. The city was rediscovered in 1849 during one of the first waves of archaeological research in Mesopotamia. Now, before we get too deep into this, I need to squash a pervasive historical myth. You see, since Uruk was such an important city in the very early history of this region, it sometimes gets implied that the word Iraq is derived from the word Uruk. Uruk, Iraq. I mean, they certainly sound alike. But the etymology of the word Iraq actually has little to do with Uruk. The Arabic name Al-Iraq has its roots in the Middle Persian name for the region. So That word is an Arabic take on a Persian word that has absolutely nothing to do with the ancient city of Uruk. So don't let anyone tell you that Uruk is the namesake of Iraq. Anyway, Uruk was located on the banks of a small offshoot of the Euphrates River in what is today southern Iraq. This tributary has since dried up, but thousands of years ago it would have flowed past this young city. The first permanent settlement in the area has been dated as early as 5000 BC. But for the first 1,000 years of its existence, Uruk was a relatively modest settlement. And you have to love super ancient history for these massively huge gulfs of time. The first period of Uruk lasts 1,000 years. That's bananas. So around 4000 BC, the city really began to expand and take shape. Huge structures were built, including a number that are mentioned in the Epic of Gilgamesh. The epic specifically makes mention of temples dedicated to the goddess Ishtar and the sky god Anu, not to mention the huge city walls that Gilgamesh himself is said to have built. Interestingly, the ruins of many of these structures have been identified by archaeologists. The most impressive of these being the massive central ziggurat. Now, a ziggurat was kind of like a step pyramid that acted as a platform for a larger temple structure. In Uruk, the temple found atop of the ziggurat is called the White Temple. The building, which most experts believe was dedicated to the god Anu, had white plaster walls. So if you were approaching Uruk from a distance, this structure would have glowed in the reflected sun. In many ways, the real-life temple is even more impressive than what was described in the epic. Cool. Imagine being someone living like 6,000 years ago, when cities are still a rare thing on this planet, and you hear about a place like Uruk. And maybe you make a trek to see it with your own eyes. You've never even seen a town before. And then there, towering before you, is something like the White Temple. Even today, it can be kind of impressive to approach a big city from a distance, especially if it has a distinctive skyline. Driving into Chicago is kind of impressive. Even my hometown of Toronto can inspire a little awe if you're coming at it from the right direction. But imagine that experience when even the idea of a city is completely novel. It must have been mind-blowing. At its height, Uruk would have been home to 40,000 people, with another 40,000 living nearby in the surrounding countryside. That means that for centuries, it was easily the largest city on the planet. That wasn't impressive enough. Archaeologists have also found evidence that a canal system ran through ancient Uruk. The archaeologist J.W.E. Fassbender even went so far as to call Uruk the, quote, Venice of Mesopotamia. So this was a truly impressive place. But what really boggles my mind is that archaeologists have determined that it was inhabited for 5,000 years before it was eventually abandoned. 5,000 years. I can barely wrap my head around that. Remember, right now we are less than 2,000 years away from the height of the Roman Empire, a time we think of as the ancient past. Uruk had a continuity stretching back more millennia than we're used to thinking about. We also know so little about those 5,000 years. We get bits and pieces, moments from reigns of kings separated by centuries. Again, it's like a radio station coming in and out of range. It reminds me that most of the human story happened deeper in the past than we often imagine, and most of it is lost to us now. And one of the things I absolutely love about the Epic of Gilgamesh is that it's so ancient that it preserves a memory of when human beings made the fateful choice to become settled city dwellers. The story of Enkidu could be read as an allegory for one of humanity's greatest transitions. Enkidu is essentially an animal when he's created. He feels a kinship with the gazelles and the wild creatures of the plain. Like all early human beings, his existence has a lot in common with Earth's other creatures. But then, Enkidu is changed. In the story, Enkidu is literally transformed through intercourse with a temple sex worker. But I'm not the first person to point out that the tempting temple woman, Shamhat, could be read as a metaphor for the comforts provided by civilization. I'm not sure if I mentioned this in my retelling, but in the epic, Shamhat also gives Enkidu beer, which he really seems to enjoy. Beer, along with bread, are basically the first human products. Settled agriculture and work specialization gets you beer, among other things, that make life a little more comfortable. When Enkidu chooses this path, he becomes less physically strong and he loses his connection with Earth's other creatures. But he gains wisdom and he gains beer. I honestly think this is one of the most beautiful and profound moments in the epic. It recognizes that we potentially lost something by becoming a city-building people. Our disconnect from nature begins there. The poem ultimately comes down hard on the side of this evolution being a good thing. I mean, Shamhat tells Enkidu that he is, quote, now like a god. But if you're like me, and you harbor some romantic notions about nature, then this moment can seem really sad. Now, of course, that's just my personal take, but I still think it's important to note that the Epic of Gilgamesh gives us a window into the moment when humanity chose the path of urban comfort, when we were literally seduced by the city. Now, there's some debate around whether or not Uruk was the first city. And by that I mean the first city on the planet, period. Now, as we've discussed before on this podcast, there are archaeological sites that are more ancient than the Sumerian cities. The temples on Malta are staggeringly old, not to mention the elaborate ritual site at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which has fascinated our old buddy Graham Hancock. But those places are generally thought to be ritual centers and not full-on cities where people lived full-time. Now, there's some evidence that cities like Jericho may have predated Uruk, and Uruk's neighboring Sumerian cities like Kish and Ur also seem to have been founded right around the same time as Gilgamesh's city. In fact, it seems like the city of Kish, located some 100 miles north up the Euphrates River, may have in the earliest times been more important than Uruk. The two Sumerian cities seem to have been rivals, with Kish originally having the upper hand and receiving tribute from Uruk. But sometime around the year 2700 BC, the dynamic shifted, we think. We know from a handful of Sumerian sources that a king named Enmabaragesi and his son, King Aga, ruled over Kish at the height of its power and influence. This information comes from two very important sources that we're going to be talking a little bit more later. They're known as the Tumal inscription and the Sumerian Kings List. Now, both of these documents seem to suggest that Kish was the preeminent city in the Tigris-Euphrates region until the end of King Aga's reign. Then, the power in the region seems to have shifted decisively towards Uruk. This shift in power is also attested to in a poem written not long after this era. At the start of the poem, King Aga of Kish is the undisputed master of the region, but King Aga overplays his hand when he demands that the city of Uruk send him a fresh batch of slaves so that Kish might build irrigation canals. In Uruk, a young leader, disgusted by this demand, defies the city's fathers, who advise capitulation, and raises an army to beat back Kish. We're told that the rebel Uruk army met Kish on the battlefield, and thanks to the heroics of the young Uruk leader, Kish was defeated. The leader then benevolently spares King Aga's life, but from that day forward, Uruk would never again pay tribute to the kings of Kish. What was the name of that young leader who freed Uruk? You guessed it. It's Gilgamesh. And even better, Enkidu also makes an appearance in this poem as one of Gilgamesh's most trusted warriors. So, you know, is this it? Is this the evidence of a historical Gilgamesh? Well, let's pump the brakes for just a second. Remember, our source here is yet another poem. It's actually called The Poem of Aga and Gilgamesh. Now, it's notable that this poem seems far more realistic than what we get in the Epic of Gilgamesh. There's no fire-breathing ogres or bulls of heaven here. The gods don't even really make an appearance in the poem of Aga and Gilgamesh. It seems far more historical in that sense. But this is still a poem. It's a narrative work filled with poetic flourishes. This should always make you wonder how much this was simply meant as a piece of entertainment or propaganda. We also shouldn't count out Gilgamesh's role as a kind of stock hero in this region. You see, there are many red herrings when it comes to our search for the historical Gilgamesh. Images of the hero appear throughout Mesopotamia in all sorts of different contexts, whether the culture producing these images are Sumerians, Akkadians, or Babylonians. These images often depict scenes from the epic, one of the most popular being Gilgamesh slaying the bull of heaven. But sometimes Gilgamesh is depicted walking beside other, presumably much later, rulers. These images can sometimes confuse a researcher who's trying to place Gilgamesh in his correct historical context. For example, there's the case of King Shulgi. King Shulgi was the king of the city-state of Ur, which was a city near the mouth of the Euphrates River that came to prominence a few centuries after Uruk. King Shulgi, who ruled over a particularly prosperous period for Ur around the turn of the second millennium BC, liked to claim that Gilgamesh was his brother. So was the real Gilgamesh actually the brother of King Shulgi? Well, probably not. Now, Shulgi was kind of an interesting figure. He was a proud patron of the arts and letters in his time, but the guy clearly had an ego, even by ancient king standards. The pronouncements that have survived from King Shulgi tell us that he prided himself on speaking many languages and actually being faster in his translations than his court interpreters. He loved music, but he also bragged that he played every instrument better than his court musicians. But most importantly for us, he made it clear that he had more ancient texts copied and set down on tablets than any other king before him. So it seems like part of the reason that the Epic of Gilgamesh survived from the earliest Sumerian period into the Babylonian period and then eventually the Assyrian period is because King Shulgi had it written down at this crucial moment. So, King Shulgi was clearly a Gilgamesh fan. When he says that he is Gilgamesh's brother, it's like later Greek kings who would claim that Hercules was their father, or Achilles was their uncle. But you can see how something like this could act as a red herring. When you're a researcher scraping together bits and pieces of the very ancient past through half-preserved tablets, finding something that says that Gilgamesh was a real guy and he was some king's brother, well, you could see how that might set you down the wrong path. But the more inscriptions by King Shulgi you read, the clearer it becomes that by his time Gilgamesh was a purely mythic figure. Specifically, King Shulgi was interested in a part of Gilgamesh's mythic identity that isn't even found in the epic. For the ancient Sumerians and other Mesopotamian cultures, Gilgamesh became a St. Peter-like figure, or a Papa Legba-like figure, if you remember our series on voodoo. Gilgamesh was the person who was thought to judge the shades of the dead as they made their way to the underworld. The story goes that after Gilgamesh's failed attempt to achieve immortality, that the gods took pity on him. He would still have to die, like any other mortal, but he would be given a special position in the underworld. He would reign over the shades of the dead and would act as their final judge. So, if you were an ancient Mesopotamian, you expected to see Gilgamesh when you died, and he would determine whether or not you went to a more pleasant corner of the underworld. King Shulgi seems to have associated himself with this particular conception of Gilgamesh. Shulgi, as king, portrays himself as a great judge, just like Gilgamesh is in the underworld. In one inscription written in Shulgi's voice, the king declares, quote, "Like my brother and friend Gilgamesh, I can recognize the virtuous and I can recognize the wicked. The virtuous get justice in my presence, and the wicked and evil person will be carried off. Who like me is able to interpret what is spoken in the heart?" End quote. Now, lines like that can at first seem like Gilgamesh is Shulgi's contemporary, that he is his brother and friend, but with a little more added context, it's clear that by Shulgi's day, Gilgamesh was a solidly mythological figure. So, if King Shulgi is a dead end, then we need to go even further back and see if there are any other scraps that point us to the historical Gilgamesh. One of the most remarkable sources we have for the history of ancient Mesopotamia comes from something known as the Sumerian Kings List. Now, this was exactly what it sounded like. A list of all the kings of the prominent cities of Sumer dating back to the earliest known times. This list has been found preserved on a number of different tablets recovered from Mesopotamian archaeological sites. Now, it's awesome that so many copies of this list have survived, and that speaks to just how ubiquitous this list would have been in some Sumerian cities around the second millennium BC. That's because not only was the Sumerian Kings List an important historical document, but it was also an important piece of political propaganda. The list was first commissioned by the kings of a Sumerian city called Isin, sometime around 2000 BC, we think. Now, I know, I've been hitting you with the names of lots of different Sumerian cities here. We've had Uruk, we've had Kish, we've had Ur. Well, now we've got Isin. I trust you, you can handle this. Anyway, Isin is yet another city-state that had its own period of regional dominance in Mesopotamia. The King's List was essentially created to legitimize the kings of Isin by showing them to be the natural inheritors of a lineage that could be traced through the kings of other powerful city-states. The message of the King's List was that the kings of Isin should be in charge because they had taken over the mandate once held by the kings of Ur, the kings of Kish, and of course, the kings of Uruk. It's been noted by many experts that Isin's rivals for power, like the kings of the city of Larsa, are notably absent from the list. So, this is a document that needs to be read with care. Clearly, it was written with a very particular political agenda. But with that said, most archaeologists believe that the King's List was actually pretty accurate, to a point. You see, as you go back in time on the Sumerian King's List, you eventually hit a point where the reigns of the kings go from being reasonable to being, well, inhuman. You see, the first king on the list, a figure named Alulim, is said to have reigned for 28,800 years. And that's not even the most outrageous reign on the list. One of his successors, Enmenluanna, has a reign of 43,200 years. Now, as the list progresses, the reigns start to shorten. The old kings of Kish are said to have reigns of several hundred years, as opposed to many thousands. Then, at one particular spot, something shifts. At around the halfway point in the list of the kings of Uruk, the reigns of the kings all of a sudden become far more reasonable. King Ur-Nungal of Uruk has a reign of 30 years. Then all of his successors in Uruk have reigns stretching from 6 years to 36 years. So, you know, these seem like real guys with recognizably human-sized reigns. But here's the really fascinating thing. You see, the last king on the list to have an impossibly long reign is Gilgamesh. On the king's list, Gilgamesh is said to have reigned in Uruk for an impressive 126 years. But then immediately after him, you get Ur-Nungal, who I just told you, reigned for a modest 30 years. So on the list, Gilgamesh is the last mythical king. Or maybe he's the first real king. It's hard to say. Once again, I'm reminded of Damrosch's vanishing point analogy. Here, on the king's list, at the exact spot where legend and history are knit together, we find the name Gilgamesh. So how should we interpret this? Well, for a long time, the assumption was simply that anyone on the list with a superhuman reign must have been a purely mythic figure. The reign is exaggerated because no real records of the person could be found by the scribe who first wrote down the king's list, or so it was assumed. But this reading has been complicated by the Tumal inscription that I mentioned earlier. So what's the Tumal inscription? Well, it's yet another piece of baked clay that was recovered from an archaeological site in Mesopotamia. But this inscription predates the Sumerian King's List, and it seems to be a fairly sober accounting of which ancient Sumerian kings were responsible for temple construction. The Tumal inscription seems to suggest that King Enmerbaragesi and his son, King Aga of Kish, were both real people, despite having impossibly long reigns on the king's list. Now, Here's the other interesting thing about the Tummal inscription. Gilgamesh is also mentioned on it. Sorry for burying the lead on that, but I wasn't quite ready to give it away yet. See, on the Tummal inscription, Gilgamesh is identified as a king who succeeded Aga and made improvements to the temple of the warrior god Enlil. So here we have a document that speaks about people with mythical reigns on the king's list, undertaking fairly regular kingly building projects. Most scholars believe that the Tummal inscription gives good evidence that all of these figures mentioned, including our man Gilgamesh, were real guys. But there are still questions. Okay, do you remember the name of Gilgamesh's dad in the epic? It's okay if you forgot. His name is Lugalbanda. He's identified as a priest king in the epic. Now, interestingly, a guy by the name of Lugalbanda appears on the king's list, but he isn't shown as Gilgamesh's father. In fact, he is two kings before Gilgamesh on the list. Then, curiously, beside Gilgamesh's name on the list, the scribe includes a note telling us that, quote, his father was a phantom, the lord of Kulaba, end quote. This sometimes also gets translated as his father being a demon. So, what does this mean? Well, Mesopotamian expert Stephanie Daly, whose work I quoted liberally in the last episode, has a theory about all this. She writes, quote, possibly Gilgamesh conquered Uruk as an outsider and then adopted as a father a famous ruler of the usurped dynasty. Subsequent usurpers in ancient Mesopotamia often acted this way, end quote. Daly makes it clear that she is guessing here, but she thinks it's possible that Gilgamesh was a conqueror, aka the son of a demon, who wrested control of Uruk away from the traditional rulers. He then cooked up a new family tree for himself in order to give himself some legitimacy. Now, if I can riff on that, I can't help but see parallels in the epic for that particular theory. Okay, hear me out here. In the beginning of the Epic of Gilgamesh, Gilgamesh is a bad king. He assaults the people of Uruk. He beats up the young men. He violates the women. In other words, he acts like a conqueror. Now, the people learn to love Gilgamesh after he encounters Enkidu and stops treating the people of Uruk like a conquered people. Now, okay, to be fair, there's no hard archaeological evidence for this particular interpretation. This is just me getting inspired by Stephanie Daly's take. Still, I'm into it. Okay, so let's step back and take a look at all the evidence. There is clearly a long mythological tradition attesting to Gilgamesh as the king of Uruk. Uruk certainly existed and even enjoyed a period of hegemony over the other Sumerian city-states. We have the Sumerian kings list that tells us that Gilgamesh was indeed a king of Uruk. He's given an impossibly long reign, but he's the last guy on the list with an impossibly long reign, which is curious. After Gilgamesh, the kings become more obviously human. Then we have the Tummal inscription that lists Gilgamesh, along with a handful of other kings on the Sumerian kings list, as being temple builders. Then we have the poem of Gilgamesh and Aga, a narrative account with no mythical elements, explaining that Gilgamesh led a resistance against the kings of Kish. Now, interestingly, Gilgamesh is presented as defying the quote-unquote city fathers when he raised his army. This kind of fits with Stephanie Daly's idea that Gilgamesh was an outsider who took power. You know, Potentially, he may still have been from Uruk, just not of the traditional ruling family, as the poem of Gilgamesh and Aga seems to suggest. It's his success against King Aga of Kish that gives him the mandate to rule. Anyway, this poem, while perhaps exaggerated, seems more like something based on historical fact than, say, the Epic of Gilgamesh. So, was there a real Gilgamesh? I'm leaning hard to yes. Gilgamesh seems to have been a real person and a real king of Uruk. He probably lived sometime between 28 and 2500 BC. And I know that's like a 300-year spread, but that's as good as we get in these ancient periods. He seems to have reigned over Uruk during a time when power was shifting in the region. The city of Kish was on the decline, and Uruk was on the come up. Now, who knows how much Gilgamesh contributed to the rise of Uruk, but he was certainly credited with this later on by poets. Finally, it seems entirely possible that Gilgamesh was an outsider or a usurper, someone who wasn't born to be the king, but who took the mantle forcefully. He was someone that the people had to learn to love, and that reputation stayed with him, even after he was transformed into a mythical hero. Now, I should reiterate that none of this is for sure. As you can see, we're working with scraps. But based on what we got, I think Gilgamesh was a real dude. The Epic of Gilgamesh is ultimately about the futility of a quest for immortality. Death and oblivion can't be escaped, and even trying is kind of sad. At the end of the poem, Gilgamesh just has his city walls that will live on as a testament to his life. Perhaps it's fitting that Gilgamesh would indeed achieve immortality thanks to a few pieces of baked clay. How many people who lived 4,000 years ago can you name? Well, now you've got at least one. Gilgamesh, King of Uruk. And if that's not immortality, then I don't know what is. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will explore a new historical myth. Before we go this week, I'd like to give a shout out to the following people. Big ups to Rabbi Moshe Greenwald. Hey, Rabbi, thanks for the kind email. Big ups, Rabbi. Big ups to Caitlin Lambert, to Michael Spitzkowski, to Tom G, to Adam Pisoni, to Megan Rivers, to Kevin Ray, to Penny Durham, and to Daniel Nevin. All of you folks have decided to pledge at $5 or more every month on Patreon, so you know what that means. You are beautiful human beings. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you to everyone on Patreon who continues to support the podcast. I've got a new interview coming up very soon for my Our Fake History in Conversation series, so be looking out for that in the next few weeks. I hope to have that to you very soon. If you're interested in Patreon, you think you want to support the show, you want to get all the awesome extras that you get with being a patron, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and check out the level of support that works for you. You can also buy one-off extra episodes through the website at ourfakehistory.com. Just follow the links there. You can also get merch for the show at tpublic.com, but the easiest way to find our tpublic shop is just to go to ourfakehistory.com and click on the links. If you want to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory. You can hit me up on Instagram at ourfakehistory. And you can hit me up on Facebook at facebook.com/ourfakehistory. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. Check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.